I want you to wrap your mind around a word. All right? Here's the word. The word is reconciliation. Reconciliation. It's a great word. It's probably familiar to most of you, but it is a word that we're going to concentrate on this morning. It is a word that actually is a biblical word. It has a real defining, you know, definition about it in a very specific way. It is a word that we use often in our own language in various ways. Let me give you some quick definitions that we have of that, and that is reconciliation could first be a change of a relationship from hostility to harmony. You've got a hostile environment, something that's horrible to a sense of harmony. It could be applied in lots of ways. It could be applied in a marriage, in a home. It could be applied between family members, between a parent and a child. It could be applied in lots of ways. It could even be applied to governments. And then certainly the other part of that is from war to peace. You have a war environment that all of a sudden is transformed over to a sense of a peaceful environment. You know, it's the very reason why governments throughout time, and the U.S. government certainly has been a major part of some of this, but has tried to form unions, have tried to form allies, have tried to form leagues of nations, have tried to form, you know, NATO, those kinds of things, so that everybody could turn what was a war situation into a situation of peace. So we're familiar with it. Just trying to get you to make sure you understand reconciliation. To reconcile two sides, in a sense. The next maybe to bring a sense of reunion. A reunion from something that once was deeply opposed. The term reunion is something I grew up with. It was a sense of a family gathering. Let's all get the Arnold clan together all at one time. You want to talk about war, you know, that could be war. Actually, no, we all get along fine, but it is an interesting, complex thing. My guess is if you got your whole family together, it might be a little bit interesting from time to time, right? You always show up with these certain cousins that you kind of look at oddly, and these people who are the renegades, and the you know, maybe my cousin who's wanted by the FBI might show up. I actually do have one of those, and God bless Wayne, but wherever Wayne is, I grew up with him. But, you know, you got to get this sort of reunion. Two sides that at one time were opposed to each other are now brought together in reunion. The Hatfields and McCoys. Maybe another part of the definition is to become committed friends after at one time we were total enemies. From enemies to friends. Which I thought we were with Russia, by the way. You know, I'm kind of half Russian sort of these days, and I always have kind of some thoughts about all of those kind of politics that go on, and I watch it with intrigue. And we certainly thought it was true between Russians and Ukrainians. They all look alike to me. They all sound alike to me. They actually are all brothers. They kind of hate each other now. I had a friend of mine, I work with a Russian church locally, and he said that, no kidding, right now, because of the Russian-Ukrainian situation going on, over there are Slavic churches, that's the term you use for that kind of whole world, there are Slavic churches that are primarily Russian, but a lot of Ukrainians in them, that are now splitting over the issue that's happening over Crimea. Hostility. We were once at enemies, but now we are friends. Another maybe might be to bring someone who was greatly wronged back into a family relationship the way it was originally intended to be. To restore somebody back into the family. Reconciliation. The one thing I want to point out to you this morning as we move forward with this term is that oftentimes when we use that term, reconciliation, the first thought that comes into most of our minds is the idea that, you're right, someone has wronged me and I need to somehow reach out to them and bring them into a relationship again, to reconcile back with them again. I need to forgive them. There is a time for that to happen. There is not one of us in this room that has not been wronged by somebody in this world. Sometimes even people in this room. Sometimes we have been wronged by others out there, and we, the scars of those wounds are pretty darn deep in our own lives. And so we get that concept, but that's usually when we talk about reconciliation. We're thinking about it from the fact that somebody wronged me, and so I need to reach out to them. Again, there is a place for that. Don actually, about 5-6 weeks ago, preached a sermon about forgiveness on that similar kind of a topic. How do you learn to get past the scars of your life to reach out in a forgiving way to somebody who wronged you? There is an absolute need and appropriate hour for that. However, the vast majority of us rarely, when we use the term reconciliation, we rarely go to the very first thought of, I wonder who I have wronged. I wonder what I did to hurt them. I wonder what I did to cause division between me and them. I wonder what guilt I play in this role of breaking that relationship with them. I want you from this point forward, for the rest of this time this morning that we're going to talk about this, is to think of yourself, not about who wronged you. There is an appropriate time for that. And there's absolutely the need to deal with that. And we have before, and we will again. But let's go to the harder subject. How have I wronged someone? How have I wronged God? What guilt do I play? It's a tough topic. I'm going to tell you two stories this morning. Two stories. One of them is a Bible story that as I tell it and get into it, you're probably going to start to recognize it. Those of you who know your Bible or your Old Testament especially, you kind of pick up on it. But, you know, just kind of listen to the story itself. It's a rather long story, and so I'm going to have to really condense it hard and work it down to just kind of give you the treetop version of this particular story. And then the second story I'm going to tell is a much more modern story. It's a modern day story that's going on actually right now. Here's story number one. One time there was a guy who had some older brothers. I have older brothers. I'm the youngest. I'm the baby of my family. This particular guy happened to be the baby of his family. Had a whole bunch of older brothers. Not just, you know, how many of you have older brothers? Older brothers? Okay, a bunch of you. Well, he had not just one or two or three. He had like 10. So he had a bunch of older brothers. And in that sense, he was a lot younger than the rest of these brothers. When you start having that many brothers, some of them are going to be in their 30s and 40s with families and kids and everything else. And in this case, he was just a teenager. He's only 17 years old. But, you know, in the unique dynamics of the story, and again, this is just the way the story works, so follow along this. But in the unique dynamics of this story, there was a lot of competition between these brothers. Pretty typical. My brothers and I, to this day, are fairly competitive. I'm just better than they are, they're not here to defend themselves. So, in that context, there was a lot of, you know, it was in ancient times, and so they were all shepherds and they were farmers and they had their possessions and their sheep and their goats and their herds and their families and their kids, and so they became fairly protective of these kind of territorial kinds of rights. Very territorial. That's pretty common amongst all of us. Very human. Hasn't ever changed in 3,000 or 4,000 years. But in the context of this particular story, this little brother, he had no family yet. And he was kind of a gifted kid, but there was other something unique about him. He was like the special kid of his parents. Parents loved him. His dad just adored him. Most of the time, a dad in those ancient cultures, it was always the firstborn son. But in this case, this was like the little boy. Just loved him. Gave him special clothes, which didn't really set well, as you can imagine. Well, the other little brother, at one point in time, too, he was also he was young and energetic. He had dreams a lot. And he came up with this idea one day. He said, "Hey, brothers, I had this dream. Guess what? In this dream I had, we were all out in the field, and we were all crops, and we were like wheat. And all our wheat fields were growing, and there was all my brothers, and then there was me. Mine got bigger than yours. In fact, even to the point where all of yours bowed down to mine. What do you think of that dream?" And then he says, later on, he says, "Oh, you know, I got this other dream. And we were all stars up in the sky, and there was sun and moon. There's mom, dad, everybody, all the brothers. We're all out here. Guess what? Mine shone a lot brighter than yours, and all of yours bowed down to me and to mine. What do you guys think of that? What do you think they thought? Fast forwarding the story, they couldn't stand him. They just absolutely couldn't stand him. They absolutely could not stand the kid. And so what they did is they wanted to kill him. To the point of murder himself. They had an argument amongst each other, and they finally decided, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to sell him off. Pretty common those days. Some slave traders came through the town, and they locked him up, threw him in a ditch, or sold him off to slave traders, and they thought to themselves, we'll never see him again. We're sick of the little brother. And they, instead of reporting that they sold him, they went to the dad and took a coat and put some blood on it from an animal and said, your son was killed by wild animals. I'm so sorry, we'll never see him again. They thought, story over. The picture that you see on your screen right now is actually a photograph from what? Do anybody know? Anybody want to take a guess? It's a dungeon. It's a slave. It's a cell. It's a jail. It's a modern day location in Western Africa of a cell where 150 years ago, 200 years ago, in Ghana, in present day Ghana, West Africa, people would go through the villages and the towns of those communities all throughout West Africa and different parts of Africa and put people in bondage and throw them into a cell. And they were there to be waited till a ship took them off into a new country to be sold off into slavery once again. Now, the story that I just told you, and I'm not quite finished with the story yet, you're probably, some of you are picking up who that was. And sometimes we hear a story like that and we forget about what that feels like. And so we kind of have to put a little bit of a modern slant on it, a little bit more modern slant, and talk about the slave trade and the unfairness of all of that. Now, in our world today, we would all go, no, that's completely wrong. And of course it is. Duh, of course it's wrong. But this is what we are. And instead of you thinking of yourself as the slave person that was caught in that dungeon, that place waited to be traded off to an unknown land, I want you to put yourself in the place of the person who sold the person into slavery. I want you to put yourself in the place of the brother that was there. We have a family in our church. I don't think they're here this morning, but they've just been a dear family in our church. They're growing older. They're sort of not really retired, but kind of retired. They're an African-American couple, Elgin and Dorothy Taylor. And they have a wonderful book that they wrote that's fascinating. And they were actually missionaries. They're from Texas originally, and they have been missionaries in multiple countries of the world, including Japan. And it's a unique story because they're African-American couple coming out of America and the South in the 50s to be missionaries into the world, and it has a unique part of the story. But Elgin has this wonderful personal story that comes along this. He grew up in a town that's not terribly far from the town that I grew up in, out in central Texas, that was a town created by free slaves. It was actually a town founded by his grandfather as a freed slave. Kind of personalizes it for you. And in his book, he talks a little bit about that. I would encourage you to read his book. In fact, I will tell you right now that in the fall at our Global Impact Celebration, Alan, they're going to be missionaries as a guest, an older couple, semi-retired, lots of experiences in the world, and they're going to be an honored guest, and they're going to be a part of our GIC missionaries during that event. It's going to be awesome. But instead of the one sold off, what about the brother that sold him? What about you? The brother that was sold off into slavery goes off into Egypt. And he, you know, he's actually quite a good manager. And so he kind of gets sold to a family and he elevates himself. He manages things so well, the guy in the household says, I'm going to raise you up to do all these good things and run my household. Well, there were some other complications. You'll have to read the story of yourself that happened. And instead he got accused wrongly. He got thrown into another jail cell. But he was so good at managing the jailhouse that the jailer in charge of the jail put him in charge of everything. So much to the point where he made an influence on some other people who were coming from Pharaoh's court. This was in Egypt. Pharaoh's court back in that jail cell. And Pharaoh himself had a problem with dreams. And somebody through a long channel and a network of things that happened, heard, said, there's this guy that's in this jail cell, in your jail cell, Pharaoh. I think he could translate your dream. And the dream was this. Pharaoh had this dream about seven sleek cows and seven hungry cows, seven fat cows, seven hungry cows. And Joseph, the young man, that's his name, said, well, the dream is God's trying to tell you there's going to be seven really good years coming ahead, but you better prepare because you got seven really years of famine right after that. And Pharaoh said, you know what? You've been proved yourself to be a great manager. I'm going to put you in charge of all that. That's the story. Now, it goes on. Back at home, here's the brothers. Here's all these brothers who knew full well what happened to their little brother. The dad was clueless. The dad thought he was dead and gone, and years had passed. But the famine that was so bad in that region had taken place. What happened is the dad and the brothers all decided, we've got to go to Egypt because we hear in Egypt there's plenty. They've had somebody who's been really storing up stuff well. We're going to go buy some food. So they went there to buy food. A long series of events took place. But as soon as these brothers showed up, guess who's in charge? The little brother. They didn't recognize him. And these brothers, kind of in a sense, sort of swept this whole thing under the rug, never recognized their little brother. The little brother, Joseph, he absolutely recognized them. Several things took place. He sold them some food. He bargained with them about some issues. He even kind of tricked them a little bit to get their other now little brother back to come. Until finally at the end of the story, as we get near the end, he couldn't stand it any longer. And these brothers who were begging for mercy and begging for food and a trade, he came up as the one sold off into slavery. He sits there with his big brothers and he says, I'm Joseph. I'm the one that you sold off. Put yourself in the shoes of the big brother. What would you do? Joseph, through the part of that story as it ends up in the chapter 50. In fact, at the very end of that, the dad even dies. And the brothers thought, you know, he was going to save her life because dad was alive. He didn't want to do anything with this. But now that dad's gone, quite honestly, he has the power because he's second to Pharaoh only. He has the power to do anything he wants to with this. Joseph had an amazing statement. And you find it in chapter 50 of verse 20 when he says, you intended harm to me, but God intended it for good because he wanted to accomplish what is now being done, and that is the saving of many lives. What you intended for harm, God meant for good. Now that's from the perspective of the one that's Joseph, the one that was wronged. But the amazing thing is that what about the one that was the one who committed the evil, the one who committed the wrong? How do they deal with that? The power of understanding your guilt is critical in the story of reconciliation. In chapter 5 of the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul writes these words to that church, and he says, therefore, since we have been made right in God's sight by faith, we have peace with God because of what Jesus Christ our Lord has done for us. Because of our faith, Christ has brought us into a place of, say it with me, undeserved privilege, where we now stand. You are the brother. You don't deserve forgiveness. In recent days, last Sunday, Mike preached a sermon which I thought was fabulous, to be honest with you. And he did a really nice job of presenting it. And I'm not just trying to be complimentary of him, but I'm trying to say to you, but the message itself is unbelievable. And that is, he talked about the holiness of Almighty God. You and I are the brothers. God Himself, the Almighty, is the holy, perfect God. In His presence, we don't stand a chance. We are wrong. We are out of sync. Every one of us. There was an old preacher a couple hundred years ago in early America who was very famous for one great sermon. His name is Jonathan Edwards. And his one great sermon was, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He would preach that sermon over and over and over again. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people came to faith because of that. Now that is politically incorrect these days. But the concept that we talked about last week that comes out of the Bible is the holiness of God cannot be compared, and there is not one of us that can stand up to His glory. And if it were not for what Jesus Christ has done, we are hopeless and helpless. We are undeserved. You are the big brother. Before you think about any reconciliation in your own life, about what it is that you feel like you deserve because somebody wronged you, don't you dare forget the incredible message of the gospel of Jesus Christ that says, guys, you are wrong. You are out of sync. You do not deserve anything. I don't care what color of skin you are. I don't care what language you speak. I don't care what side of the tracks that you come from. I don't care if you have money or no money. You deserve death. We are not holy people, and we stand in the presence of a holy God. But there's hope because Christ did this for us. It's an undeserved privilege. Here's my second story. It's a lot more modern. Tomorrow is April 7th, 2014. On April 7th, 1994, 20 years ago tomorrow, something very special happened in the world. Anybody know? Historical event. Anybody know? They guessed it in the first service. The Rwandan genocide, I think I heard. It's exactly right. In the country of Rwanda, a small African country in kind of eastern Africa, if you know your geography, we talk a lot about Uganda. It actually borders Uganda. One part of its border is Uganda. Not that far from Bulisa, where we talked about a while ago. Borders part of Kenya. It borders, you know, the Congo. It's a small country geographically. But on April the 7th, 1994, a very famous, terribly sad event happened, and that is, we call it the Rwandan genocide kicked off. Now, you know, those of us who are Americans, we sort of lose sight sometimes of the tribal kinds of things that go on in the world. We do have Africans in our church, actually several here even right now, who are from, born and raised in Africa. And so you might have a better grasp of that, but in our Western kind of world, we kind of forget about that a little bit. We don't really quite grasp it. My son served in Iraq for a while, and the same concept runs in that part of the Middle Eastern world as well. So you have these kind of tribal things going on. And these tribal things going on sometimes go way back, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and sometimes even thousands of years. Americans, we kind of forget about that because if it's before 1998, we don't care. So, but in that world, there's a lot of things going on. And so there are multiple tribes there, and I'm no great expert on Rwanda, but there's these two tribes, and one of them's the Hutu tribe, and they were the majority, and one of them's the minority tribe, with the Tutsi. On our Friday night group, our church has, as a part of our mission work that we do, we have a nice, wonderful little international student gathering that meets down in Auburn and part of a Green River Community College, and one of our young ladies is from Rwanda. It's very cool. Her name is Lily. She's a sweet girl. She's actually one of the Christians that's actually in that group. Not everybody is, certainly. But she's the only African. She's the only, certainly, Rwandan that I've ever met at GRCC College. But sweet little girl. In fact, I've asked her one of these days, I'd really like to come and interview her. She's a great story, and she's a cool kid. Just a charming young lady. And cute, by the way. She's single, too, just to let you guys know. But Lily is a sweet girl. But the point is, she reminded me Friday night, she said, yeah. And she has always this big smile on her face. She's just charming. And she says, yeah, Monday's the anniversary. And I said, Lily, how old are you? She said, well, I'm about 20. I think she's like 21. I said, you were like 6 months old or something when this took place. She said, yep. I was there. My parents were there. My family was there. And we were all affected by it. Makes it really personal, right? On April 7, 1994, the Hutu tribe, after a long sense of bitter rivalries and don't even understand the complexities of it at all, and actually it almost doesn't matter because it's just like every other genocide that's ever happened in history, they all end up being the same. Somebody hates each other, one another bad enough that finally they pull out knives and weapons and they just decide, we want you gone. And that's what they did. And in 100 days' time, 100 days that kicked off on April 7, 1994, what we found is that they believe that somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people were killed in 100 days. You ever seen the movie Hotel Rwanda? It's worth watching. It's painful, but it's worth watching. 300,000 children were murdered in 100 days. Somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 women were raped in 100 days. 2 million people had to flee their homes and become immediate refugees in that just a little over 3 month period of time because of the chaos that took place. I brought a little bit of an illustration for you, which I thought I'd pull out. And I don't want to be too graphic, but I want you to capture the meaning behind it. Almost most of them were killed with a machete or at gunpoint. And they were often killed by the people who used to be their next door neighbors. And they would take the weapons and implements of what was to farm the fields and now literally massacred the people in their community. And a painful genocide took place. It was chaos reigning at its highest degree. Sadly enough, it's not the only time in history that it's ever happened. It's happened plenty of times and still happens today. These were neighbors killing each other. Rwanda will tell you, and Lily will tell you, that Rwanda, just like every other country, is not a perfect place. So it's a beautiful country. Anybody ever been there? In here? Some of you have. It's a gorgeous place. But she says that Rwanda actually is healing. There's actually a real sense of renewal. Now, they still got plenty of problems and the scars that are there. You can't just pull out weapons like this and kill your neighbors and then love you next door. But it's really healing. But you know how it's healing? Let me kind of describe to you what I have come to understand of one of the great ways that it's healed and is in the process of being healed. There's some great books written out. I'm reading one right now. But there's a great tool that they decided to use. There was 50, 60, 70,000 offenders who literally went around and murdered their neighbors. And they don't, you know, the one thing they didn't do and weren't able to do is put them all in prison when the whole thing's over. You can't just put 60, 70,000 people in prison and say, well, you go right away. They have a justice system there that has actually been a part of the healing process of this nation, the slow but surely healing process. And I'm going to use a couple of African words just because that's the word that's used. But there's a word they use for that is in the court system there that they call gachacha. Now, in the Western court world, the world that we live in, if you created an offense and you were guilty of something, you're gonna go to a trial judge, but you're gonna grab as best a lawyer that you possibly can afford, and you're probably gonna not tell everything that you need to tell. In fact, you're gonna kind of claim somewhat some innocence for whatever reason that it is along the way, and you're gonna make everybody else prove that you were guilty before they finally sentenced you, either guilty or not guilty. In the gachacha system, it doesn't work that way. What they do is they get you, the one who created the offense, and the community of people that you offended, and the elders of the community around you, and they all gather under a tree. And this is kind of important. The name of the tree often is called the Umuvu, Umuvumu tree. Pardon me for my bad Rwandan pronunciation, but that's what it's called, Umuvumu tree. And they gather under this tree, and the first thing that you have to do as the one who created the offense is you have to be brutally honest. Yep, I pulled out a machete, and I killed my neighbors. You have to be brutally honest. But in that system, they come back around, and then they immediately, the elders of the community, try to figure out a way that the one who was offended brings about a sense of restoration to allow you to continue to live next door. But the Umuvumu tree is very important here because in that particular tree, there's a long history in the Rwandan culture that this special tree, it goes way back. They would literally scrape off a portion of the bark of this tree. They would create a scar. And over a period of time, scar tissue would grow back over the top of that tree, and it was a reddish, brownish bark kind of a thing that was obviously a healing kind of a thing. But then later they would take that scarring, healing material, and that's the material that they use to create the dress for royalty in that culture. They would create purses out of it. They would create maps of Africa out of it. They would use it for the royalty of the king. Why? Because it proved that healing is possible and reconciliation is needed. It's a fairly graphic story. But that story reminds me of what Isaiah said in Isaiah chapter 53 when he was talking about the sins of all of humanity. The people who offended, that's you, that's me. And he said this, "For he was pierced for our transgression, he was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed." In the story of reconciliation, the one thing that each one of us needs to come to understand is how wrong we are. I think we way too sugarcoat too often the offenses that we make, certainly to other people, but absolutely to the Almighty, Holy God. We are the offenders. We are the ones that carry the machete. We are the ones that do not deserve any life. We don't deserve reconciliation. We don't deserve being healed. But in Romans chapter 5, this passage that's inside your program this morning that is so powerful, it says this, "But God showed His great love for us by sending Christ to die for us even while I was still the sinner." Even while I had the machete in my hand. Even while I was the one who brought the greatest offense against the Holy God. Christ died for me. For you. Reconciliation is not just a word that says, "Gee, everybody's wronged me in my life." The truth is, you've got to start with yourself. And you've got to understand how desperate you are, and I am in need of this holy God. But understanding the fact of what Jesus Christ was paid that price, built that bridge, it came from Him and Him alone. You don't deserve it. I don't deserve it. There's not one of us in this room that does. But God, in His incredible graciousness, gave it to each one of us. I think each one of us has to come to a point where we say, "I admit, God, that I am wrong. I admit that I hold a machete in my hand. I give that to You, and fully under the tree of forgiveness, I gather with You, the Almighty God, and say, 'God, I'm wrong. I'm wrong. I know I'm wrong. I admit it.'" And then take this invitation of the Almighty God through Jesus Christ, who says, "This true ultimate forgiveness of healing, this scar of healing material can be yours because of the price that Jesus Christ has paid." And you can be restored. You can be brought back into the family. And you can live like God intended for you to live. It could be yours. I'm going to invite our worship team if they would. If they'd come on up. But I want us to pray. I want us to pray for my own reconciliation. Not as the one who was offended, but the one who created the offense. Every one of us. Can we do that? I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to put yourself in the place of the brother who created the offense. Put yourself in the shoes of the neighbor who created offense of the neighbor. I want you to put yourself in the shoes of you who falls so far short of God. God, to say I'm sorry is just not even good enough. To say that I've fallen short is just an understatement of the year. But however we need to say it, God, we are in desperate need of you. I have offended you. I am far short of you. But God, I want to, and you could pray this with me. God, I want to thank you for what Jesus Christ has done, and by his own scars, I can be healed. And oh my goodness, what a gracious God you are. And I can find a sense of full restoration and reconciliation back to you because of the price that Jesus paid for me on the cross. I invite you into my life. I'm asking you, come into my heart and heal me. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. And now I can live my life when I invite you, the great healer, into me. I can live the rest of my days with the confidence that even at one time I used to hold a machete, that now I can hold peace with you, and I can go forward in this world with your great message of peace as well. Thank you, Jesus.